at home, I know I got nothing. And if not, I'm gonna get my sons, you know where he is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a book recently, Underground Railroad Quilts, and I want to make one. And I was wanting to take a class on the significance, and that's kind of why I asked about your shirt, of the fabric, because I know that there's a significance in fabric and everything.
I don't know what it is. What it is.
You need to get a seamstress or a person who quilts.
Yes, I do.
I know a seamstress. Maybe I can hook you up with that person.
Maybe.
You know Joyce, don't you?
She make quilts.
She was one of the instructors for our quilt class here.
I need to talk to her. I need to have
do
a
you?
Quilt made. Mm-hmm. I need to have a quilt made.
Okay. We had a whole lot of ladies from Signal Mountain that came down and helped talk the class, yeah.
Yeah, I need to have some quilt made because I got enough t-shirts to make it.
We'll get in contact with those ladies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
When COVID came, it kind of shut the quilt class down, mm-hmm. but they still
they
wanted
to
come back.
Hey, y'all got to be quiet.
Let me see.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
Oh, I'm
sorry.
You be quiet. We got to hush.
Jay, can you tell me if I'm in the frame?
Yeah.
Hey, you guys got to be
yes, you are in frame.
Okay. Alright. What's going on, Chattanooga? It's your girl, Zynab Kate, here with Brew Media Group. And today, we are dipping back into history. You know, it has a way of being left out of the education system, especially slipping through the cracks of time. But today, we're doing our due diligence to revive some of what may have been forgotten, focusing on civil rights right here in our very own backyard with Mr. Johnny D. Holloway. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good.
Oh, that's good to hear.
I'm doing better than I thought I was going to do.
Amen. And you're going to continue to do that.
Yes, I hope.
Now, you are a civil rights figure. We're going to just take it back to how you grew up, where it all started. I seen that you grew up in Chattanooga, but you were actually born in Alabama.
That's right.
Tell me about your upbringing.
Tell you about what?
Your upbringing.
Oh, well, I was brought into a family. Well, I really wasn't brought into a family. I was raised by a village.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in the projects. We moved in the projects back in 1942, I think. One of the first people to move, one of the first family to move into the West Side project. I was getting ready to get rid of that, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another story, but we were raised by not a real strict family, but a very disciplined family. And it's some basic things you had to do. You had to do your chores. You had to go to school. You had to go to church. And then you had to finish high school. At least finish high school. That was a total requirement in my family. And another thing in our family that most people don't know, that was no pass, no play, was already in my family before they put it in school.
Okay.
Because if we didn't go to church, and if we didn't get our grades right, we didn't play nothing. We didn't go nowhere.
They was not playing that. Your parents were not playing at all.
No, they didn't play at all. But if you did all the things you're supposed to do, you had free reign, because there wasn't much left to do.
Yeah. So, what was it like being in a part of both communities, first growing up in Alabama? What was that like?
I didn't grow up in Alabama. I was born in Alabama.
You
was
born?
I was 3 weeks old when we moved.
And y'all moved, okay. Yes.
At least that's what they tell me.
So growing up in Chattanooga, what was it like? Well, from as far as you can remember.
Well, I grew up in Chattanooga like a just normal black kid. I'm just believing everything is all right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm buying all the hype. And so I just lived a normal life, and until I found out they were lying to me.
What was the lies?
Well, the first lie came in school when they told me that Egypt was not in Africa. It was in Asia Minor, and I'm looking at the map. And I began to wonder. Then the second time was when they was getting ready to integrate schools, so they were trying to get us ready for integration.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a program in Chattanooga where we would have exchange between the white and black schools. So we went to City High School and they would come over to Howard. And when we was over to City High School, I saw a word on the board and it was capitalist. Now I'm amazed. I majored in I'm a minor in math. I love math. So they said, that's math. And so when they said that was a form of math, I really got interested in it. So why don't we have this at our school? They got those here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's the second lie I found out. So I went back to Howard, and so I started asking Mrs. Blackshear, one of my teachers,
mm-hmm.
why we didn't have calculus at our school. She said, you got to have, she told me, said, you got to have trigonometry first for taking calculus.
So you cannot skip the process.
So we behind already. And I'm sitting here thinking, I done bought the American dream now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting here thinking, how can I compete with these kids when they can talk something different than we can talk? I didn't know they was good enough to do a certain kind of job. White people get to, I didn't know that. I'm buying the American dream.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm accepting all this separate but equal stuff. I'm buying totally, hardly, just right into it. I didn't care. I'm buying all these lies.
And at what point did you realize it was a lie?
Well, the first one was what I just told you before about Egypt. The second was the calculus thing. So I began to try to get trigonometry at Howard. So I asked Ms. Blackshear, how did you get trigonometry in the curriculum at Howard? So mm-hmm. she told me that you had to go to your principal. Talked to him about the principal was Mr. Davenport. So I went to Mr. Davenport and said, Mr. Davenport, now I'm doing this all by myself. Now I don't know no better. I said, Mr. Davenport, we like to have trigonometry at Howard. He said, well, you got to have students that want it. I said, okay. So I went to all the students who had took geometry.
Mm-hmm.
And said, so, would y'all like to have trigonometry? They all said, yeah. So I went back to them and said, well, we got the students now, what I do?
Mm-hmm.
He said, you got to have a teacher. I went back to Ms. Blackshear. I said, Ms. Blackshear, can you teach trigonometry? She said, yeah. Now we got a teacher. Now what do we do? Now I am shaking Mr. Davenport up because he got to go to school for it now.
Yeah.
And ask the white folks for something they didn't intend for us to have.
So did y'all get it?
I had just went to my junior year in college before we got trigonometry at Howard. But every year, every time I came back home, I checked on it.
Yeah.
Until we got it.
Well, that's good. Eventually it came. It took a while.
It takes a time.
Yeah. So you grew up during this time where it wasn't really acceptable to mingle with other races. Tell me your earliest memory that you had experiencing racism, segregation from that time.
Well, let me tell you about that. We lived in the West Side Project,
mm-hmm.
and Cameron Hill, right up the hill from West Side. And white people lived on Cameron Hill, and a few black people lived on Cameron Hill, too.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a grassy knoll on the hill,
okay.
that all the children, black and white, just used to get on them cardboard boxes and ride down the hill. So it was black and white kids. So I was riding down on the hill with a little white kid. So I always had lunch. So it was about time for lunch. So I said, you want to come on, go home with me for lunch? He said, yeah. I'm talking to this white kid. I take this white kid to my house for lunch. And I saw the expression on my mother's face.
But he still ate though, yeah?
Yeah, he ate. She gave us the meal. But I knew I had done something wrong. But I didn't ever ask about it till years later. But I already knew what I'd done wrong then. That was my first experience. Yeah.
So he never came back? You never brought him back over?
Oh, I didn't bring him back. No.
That was his first and his last meal over there. Oh my God.
That was my first experience with what was going on, the separate but equal thing.
Oh my goodness. So how did those early experiences shape your understanding of equality and justice at such a young age? Because how old were you when that happened, when you guys were sliding
down? I was about 7 or 8 years old.
Okay. So how did those experiences like that shape your understanding of equality?
Well, I didn't really have much of an understanding then. I just knew I'd done something wrong and I just mm-hmm. didn't do it no more. And then I just rocked along like everybody else did.
Did you continue to play with?
Oh yeah, we played with white kids.
Okay. So it wasn't as bad.
Well, you know, kids are kids. We don't know all this other stuff. We haven't learned all that stuff yet.
Okay.
So kids are kids. One thing about kids, they're clean slate. They don't know all this stuff. They gotta learn all this stuff. They hate stuff. They gotta learn all that.
So around what age was it
not saying that you learned all of that, but did that become apparent where it's like, okay, I can't even do this anymore?
Well,
this is not okay.
When we used to go downtown, that's when I first got the first lesson. I ran into this white water and this black water and colored water, they call it. And so my mother, and curious as I was, so I want to find out what this white water tastes like. So I'm going to drink it. I didn't quite find my mother about to have a fit. She said, boy, you're not going to. I said, I just want to know what the difference in the water.
Was there a difference?
Not that I knew of. And my mother would have a fit. Then we used to go downtown, and you used to ride the elevator. That was a fun time for us. But with only one place we'd go to the bathroom. That was at Union Station. It was down there by where the Reed House is, like Carl from Reed House. Union Station was trained for me. That's the only place we'd go to the bathroom. So we had to plan our trips to the bathroom and going to town and all this kind of stuff. That's when I began to realize something was wrong with this whole thing.
And then how was it from there that you began to become interested in the civil rights movement? If not, then what sparked your interest in you saying, hey, I want to stand up for equality, for peace, for unity?
I guess that started when I was when I went to Alabama A&M College. The experience I had at Alabama A&M taught me a lot. And it kind of got me in the path I'm on now. Well, I was playing. I got a scholarship to play basketball at Alabama A&M. Mr. Dave, a coach that had some connection to Alabama, so he saw me playing basketball in the Industrial Y at the YMCA. And he said, what you gonna do when you finish school? I said, I'll probably go to the military and get a job. I don't know what I'm gonna do. He said, would you go to school if I got this scholarship? I said, yeah. So he got me a scholarship. And I went to Alabama A&M. And when I got to Alabama A&M, it was a culture shock.
Really? What were you expecting versus what you saw?
What I was expecting when I went to Alabama, what I learned in Tennessee. My experience in Tennessee after I was transferred to Alabama.
No, that was not the case.
No, by no means.
Yeah.
Not close. And the first thing, I made a D in college orientation. Just learned how to deal with college. I made a D in it.
Were you not in class? Were you
no,
not
it wasn't a class. It's orientation to college. It's how you're supposed to act in college.
So how you feel that?
Well, let me tell you about that. Well, we had a meeting for all the students, all the freshman students, and everything. So they started telling us how to treat white people. I was the only person that got up and walked out the whole meeting. And I went on back to my room because I just thought it was ridiculous to try to tell me how to treat people. My mother and father taught me that.
Right.
So I left. So I was called before the disciplinary committee. And they wanted to know why I walked out of the meeting. I told her, I didn't need that. I didn't know you come down here to college for that.
Right.
To how to treat people. I said, my dad and my mother taught me that.
That's crazy.
And from then on, if something went wrong on that campus, it was 8 people, and we was all out of state students.
Okay.
That they called in and said we were the cause of it.
Of any issues?
Any silly issue. Now, I wasn't a silly person. And they would blame us because we were out-of-state students. And Mr. Blackshear, my political science teacher, taught me why. And the why of it, we was out-of-state students. And the philosophy of Alabama was, if you were born in Alabama, raised in Alabama, educated in Alabama, you wouldn't do anything to embarrass Alabama, so it had to be everybody else.
But you have at least like 10% of that because you was born in Alabama.
But I was raised in Alabama.
So that should count
and
for
I didn't
something.
Go to school in Alabama. I was a baby when I left Alabama, so I don't know nothing about Alabama, except when I went back to visit my relatives.
That's crazy. It's unfair.
But that's the philosophy.
So how did the next few years go?
The next few years were rough. Because every time something went wrong on camp, they would call us ADN. And I got tired of that. And I said, well, if that's the way y'all gonna treat us, I'm gonna show you what I would do if okay. I was gonna do something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I ran with the smartest students on the campus. His name was Robert Miller. Never forget his name. He made A's in kindergarten. He never made a B in his life till he got to Alabama A&M College. And it upset him so. It psychologically upset him for a teacher to give him a B. And I had to tell him that it wasn't because you didn't make an A, it's because the teacher just wanted to make an example of you.
Yes.
That you're not smarter than I am. And I said, I'm telling you, you're smarter than she is. And I had to talk him down and get him level back on his feet again. And so I said, I looked at Miller and said, you ought to run for student council president. And he said, why? I said, because we got a list of grievances that we need to be addressed. And I said, you don't even have to campaign. Yeah. Everybody gonna vote for you because you just put your name on the ballot and everybody vote for you. And then we did get him in to be the president. This was the end of my sophomore year.
Oh.
Getting ready to go into junior. And so we made the list of grievances my junior year now. We made a list of grievances and everything we had to do. And we carried it to the president. The president came to me and said, what is this? And he tried to explain to him, he got to walk out on us. I just told him, said, you'll be back.
He came back.
Yeah, he came back afterwards. Because we had already figured that he wasn't going to pay attention. We had already planned on shutting the school down. So we closed, we closed school down for 10 days. There were 10 students to go to school out of over 3,000 students. Only 10 students went to
class.
Oh,
I know they were mad.
And they blamed me.
But you was there, though.
I was the organizer.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was the one time that they could definitely.
They were right.
Yeah.
They were right. And so we finally got the president to come back and talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said that he thought there was some legitimate grievance and he would address them.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay. I said, but you need to put something in writing to us.
Yes.
And he said, why, you can't take my word? I said, it's not a matter of taking your word. Is that if I go before the student body and say, you said this and you mm-hmm, said that, mm-hmm. then you don't do it. I said, who you think they're going to come after? That's going to be me. I said, you got to put something in writing before I do anything. And he got mad at me. But he finally put something in writing.
It take a little push sometimes.
Now, I learned a lesson about protesting.
In that moment?
Yeah, in that moment. So the press got hold to it, you know they did. So they were interviewing me. And so I said, we're going to strike Alabama and A&M off the face of the earth. And you know what came out of the newspaper? Students said they're going to bomb
yes,
the
campus. Yes,
so you got to watch your language mm-hmm. when you're interviewing.
They'll twist it.
So I said, I didn't say that. They said, I know you didn't, but that's the way they interpreted it. That was my first interview. That was my first experience with the press.
Oh, my gosh.
And then my trouble started. I have a scholarship, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't take my scholarship because I was a pretty good student. And I was making A's in my major, in my minor anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they took my house away from me. So if you take your house away from me, you ain't got no place to stay.
Right.
So you just meant to go home. Let me tell you what happened. A coach at Council High School named Condry Tolloway. I had been planning on meeting them because they live right down off the campus.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I said, I'm going down and see what this country of Hollywood is like.
Yeah.
And I had already seen he was kind of dark, so I figured he's part of the family anyway. So I went down to knock on the door and said, my name is John Holloway. And he looked at me and said, are you John Holloway's son? I said, yes. He said, John Holloway is my second cousin.
Aww.
And so I said, I need a place to stay. He said, for what? I said, they took my house away from me. He said, but you still in school? He said, yes. I said, but if I don't have a place to stay, I got to go home.
Right.
At that time, his wife had just left him with two children. So he said, you can come down here and stay with me to help me raise my children. I stayed down there for 2 years and helped raise Candace Holloway and Valerie Holloway. And you know who Candace Holloway is?
Who?
The first black quarterback at Tennessee, University of Tennessee.
Yes.
That's him.
I know you was proud.
Well.
Yes. So you get through college. Did you graduate?
Yeah. Well, no, I didn't graduate now. They said I wasn't. I walked down the Capitol with another professor and looked at me and said, you'll never graduate. I said, what do you mean I won't graduate? He said, you'll never graduate from Alabama. Yeah, yeah. I said, okay. I said, I don't have to graduate. I said, I don't care too much of ceremonies anyway. All I want is a degree.
Yeah.
I said, you're going to give me my degree.
Did they give it?
Yeah, they finally gave it to me, though. But I was at home working. I couldn't find a job anywhere in the United States in my field. I wanted to be an engineer, architect, and so I wanted to work under an engineer. That's another thing they did to me, took the scholarship away from me, my graduate scholarship. I was supposed to go to graduate school to be an engineer, to be an architect engineer. They took that away from me. So, and I'm running around there trying to find a job after I graduated. I mean, after I left school, I didn't graduate. I'm running out trying to find a job. I couldn't find a job in the nation anyway. Out of this whole nation, I rolled out all over this nation trying to find a company. And I think it was North or South Carolina accepted me. But they must not have known what Alabama Indian was. Because I got a letter later before I left canceling that opening.
Did it say why?
No, they don't say no. They just canceled it. They don't have to answer you. They just said cancel it. When they found out what kind of school Alabama A&M, they just canceled the whole thing. They hired somebody else, but that's the way it is. And I applied to all the schools. Now let me tell you what happened after that. I started working for George Key, building houses. And I was designing the houses and building the houses. And we built quite a few houses. I designed a few offices. I designed quite a few houses in Chattanooga. And so I was talking to George Key one day. I said, George Key, you know they haven't sent me my degree from Alabama A&M. I'm going to get me a lawyer. He said, he asked me why. I went through the whole story just like I did you. And he said, let me write him a letter and see what they'll do. Now, George Key knew some people at Alabama A&M. Just like Jane Daly when I got the scholarship.
Yeah.
George Key knew some other. He wrote them a letter. I don't know what he said in the letter, but they sent me my degree. That's how I got my degree from Alabama A&M. But I paid all my fees to graduate, because you don't let them keep you from graduating, keep them saying because without you fulfill all your obligations. So I fulfilled all, I paid all my fees and bought my robe and everything.
And couldn't even walk.
I didn't want to walk. I don't care about ceremony. I never have been type of ceremony, not my thing. I think that paying for all that pomp and ceremony for all other people, I don't deal with that.
So you eventually get your degree. You're working. You eventually get to work.
No. I start working for George Key. Yeah, George Key was building houses.
Okay.
That's how I just started working. I just had to make some kind of money somewhere. And then I had been exempted from the draft because I was in a critical area in school.
Okay.
And so the draft people had got to know me because I had to write a letter to show that I'm still qualified for the draft. And so the lady got to know me pretty good. She said, John, I'm going to do you a favor. I said, what kind of favor are you going to do me? She said, I'm going to call you before we draft you. So if you don't want to go to the Army, you can join some other branch of service.
Yeah.
She did call me and said, we're going to draft you in about 3 weeks. So I joined the Air Force.
So you wanted to?
I wanted to go in the Air Force, keep going in the Army.
Okay.
that's
so
where
you wanted to. So at that time, you had to, like, it was no choice. You were drafted when you were called. So if they called you, you had to go.
Yes.
And then you chose the branch or?
No. See, if they give you a chance to volunteer to go to some other branch, you do that before they draft you.
Okay.
So she let me know that I'm going to draft you in 3 weeks.
Okay.
So I joined the Air Force before
you. Good. How was that? I'm sure there was some fun there. No?
It was It was something. After I took all the tests, the guy said they're going to put me in engineering. They lied to me. They put me in the Air Police Service because I was 6'1". And I was real coordinated, muscular and everything. And I just looked like I could handle it. They put me in the Air Police now. I'm mad in hell now. Because I want to go into engineering. Because it would advance my own training in college. That's a dumb connection. They put me in the Air Police. I stayed in the Air Police for a few months. And I went to my science station in Arizona, Davis Monthan. After I got through my basic training. And I played basketball on the team too. We had a basketball team. So I was in the office on the basketball team with me. So he started talking to me one day and he said, I hear you got a degree. I said, yeah, I got one. He said, did they give you a bypass test? I said, no, what's a bypass test? Mm-hmm. He said, that's a test if you got a college degree, they give you when you come in the military, and if you pass it, you go into your field. Mm-hmm. I said, no, I never heard of bypass test. They didn't tell me about that.
Now, at that time, how long had you been in when you
first? I had been through basic training, and I was on my science station in Arizona. So I had been in about 3 or 4 months.
Okay. Not too bad.
That's not too bad, you say. But then, when nobody tell me about the bypass, I couldn't find out about the bypass. And so I wrote to my congressman. I was in Arizona, so I wrote to 2 senators from Arizona, and I wrote to 2 senators from Tennessee. Goldwater from Arizona replied to my request to be transferred to give the bypass test. I wasn't asking nothing now.
Yeah.
I just wanted to take the bypass test. Well, when Goldwater responded to my letter, it must have been pretty hot, because they didn't give me no test. They didn't do nothing to me. They just put me over into engineering.
That's cool. Now you're doing what you
want to do. I want to do what I do. I'm in engineering. I'm over the drafting section of engineering.
Yes. Now, from there, when did the civil rights activists come into play?
It's already in there. It's kind of gotten in there. Mm-hmm. But then, in the military, I guess this one is really starting. McNamara was a Secretary of Defense, I think they called it then. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he wrote a letter to all of his commanders, telling them to document any discrimination they find out that's happening on their base. And my base commander, I'm in Japan now, my base commander says there's no discrimination. He lied. And so McNamara wrote him a letter back and said, go find some. And that's when he got serious. Mm-hmm. And he didn't know anybody. So he started asking around, said, who could tell me about what's going on?
They found you.
And they said, don't talk to Jenna Holloway. Because I had already been working with some of the athletes about housing discrimination. And we had won those cases. And I was working with the Little League in the military and all that. I was doing whatever. I just loved to work with kids. And so the base commander called me and asked me about anything. So I started telling him about my experience in Arizona. And my experience in Arizona was that I figured Arizona, when I came home on leave, I go straight to Arizona. I done bought some skates. Because I'm fancy to be a pretty good skater, so I'm going to skate in Arizona because I couldn't skate in Chattanooga. So I bought the top of the line skates. And I go out to Arizona and went down to the skating rink and slid my money up there. The lady said, the day not your day. I said, what? I said, well, what is my day? She said, your day is Sunday. It's okay. I took my money back. I went back to the base because now I'm getting the picture now. Mm-hmm. I've been through this enough now I can understand it.
Yes.
So I take my money back and I go to back by my base on Sunday morning, about 2:30 in the morning. I wake up and put my skates on.
Why? In the back.
Because the lady told me I could skate on Sunday. I start skating up and down the barracks, waking everybody up, hopping up and down the hall. And everybody's mad at me.
Yes.
Said, what's wrong with you, Johnny? You gone crazy? How long did they call me? How long are you going to stop? They told me downtown I can skate on Sunday, so I'm skating. That gets me to my first sergeant. Mm-hmm. I'm a sergeant and say, are you crazy? He said, my first sergeant said, you need to see a psychiatrist. I said, you're probably right. I said, but I don't want no white psychiatrist. I want a black psychiatrist to analyze my problem. As a white, because I kind of don't know what's going on with me. And I'll pay for it myself. Y'all don't have to pay. I didn't have a dime in pocket.
Did they give you one up?
Well, that got me to my captain. My captain said, why are you here? Well, I don't understand. I said, well, the lady downtown told me I could skate on Sunday, so I just thought I'd skate right here on Sunday.
Did you ever go back to the... Why not?
Well, I didn't finish. And so... So my captain said, well, if you need to think, I told him the same story about seeing this black psychiatrist. And he kind of got upset with me. He didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. I told him I wouldn't go, I'm going to disobey no orders. I said, that'd get you in trouble. I said, if you don't think I'll see a psychiatrist, I'm willing to pay for him. He's going to be a black guy. And then I told my captain, I said, I'm gonna have all white people declared crazy. Just right there. And he looked at me and said, and that got me to the base commander. So I have a problem with the base commander. When you go see your base commander, you better put on your dress blue and get all square. So I put on my dress blue. And so base commander said, why are you here? So I started telling him about the experience I've had in Arizona. I told him all this in Japan too. And so, so he looked at me and said, aren't you one of my basketball players? I said, yes, sir. I said, and we winning too. Mm-hmm. And so we started talking about basketball. For about 30 minutes, we talked basketball. You see, base commanders love their sports because they're just like owners of sports, owners of the team. Mm-hmm. And they like for their team to win because they can brag with another base commander, my team better than your team and all that. That's what the base commanders do. They like that stuff. And so we talked basketball a little bit, and I told him, say, there's a center down here at the base in Hawaii that we could use if you can get him. We didn't get him because the base commander down there, I ranked it. Mm-hmm. We didn't get him, but I told him he tried, but he couldn't get it. And I said, so we finally got around back to where I was at. I said, let me tell you what. And he said, well, he said, what's the solution to the problem? I said, okay, I can tell you the solution to the problem. I said, tell you what to do. I said, we got Davis Mother Air Force Base. We got another Army base here. We got another Air Force base right around the airplane, same area. I said, you get with the base commanders, and you say to Tucson, Arizona, to the mayor of Tucson, Arizona, none of my troops is coming back downtown, so all my troops can go where all of them go. I said, that's all you got to do. Pick up that phone and call the mayor and tell him that. Because that town just thrive off the money from the newspaper. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I left. And so he didn't say he liked it or nothing. He just said, okay, dismiss. So I left. But about 2 or 3 weeks later, he allowed the newspaper, all the military people would be treated the same in Tucson, Arizona. I'm not saying I had anything to do with that, but that's what happened.
He kind of did.
And so I went back downtown and kind of looked after they said that, and all the troops were there, black and white. Just skating their little head off.
That's so good.
I did not ever skate in Arizona.
Why?
Because that's the way I am.
You was like, okay, my work here is done. Moving on. Moving on. So, moving on from that, what did you end up doing?
Well, John F. Kennedy had a great impact on my life. Mm-hmm. He passed an executive order saying, if you did not have the Congress Negroes in, if you did not have a Negro working in the category of about $12,000 a year, can you imagine that? If you had a military contract, we're going to reevaluate your contract. You know all of the countries I went to looking for a job?
They was calling.
In the Army. Mm-hmm. I'm in the Air Force, they calling me. One company called me and said, you applied for a job. I said, yes, I remember that. He said, we probably got a position. I said, but you're aeronautical, and I don't know nothing about aeronautics, but mm-hmm. you know engineering, and we can teach you what we want you to know.
Look at that.
I said, well, I'm gonna tell you a little secret. I said, if you can break this contract I got with the Air Force, I'll be there tomorrow. You know they can't break that contract. I'm there before you. And I had all, but then another thing happened with John F. Kennedy. He allowed the companies to start recruiting on the military basis. That's how I got my job with the Corps of Engineers. I went for an interview for a job when I got through with my tour. Mm-hmm. I went down and saw some jobs. I applied for them. The guy said, well, we have a job for you at the Corps of Engineers in Seattle, Washington. That's what suited me to the T. I'm in engineering now.
That's good.
So I come back home. I don't know what's good about it. I come back home and my whole family. Well, you know, things are opening up now, and you ought to try to apply for the jobs I already applied for 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't want to go through that again. I already got a job in Seattle. I'm going to take my wife. I had gotten married, and we're going to Seattle, Washington. My mother was mad. My sister was mad with my father. Everybody was upset with me because I wouldn't apply for a job in Chattanooga.
Was there something wrong with there, or you just...
I already been through that. I've done that. I'm through with it.
So you're like, if I tried something, I'm done.
I'm done. I'm going on. I already got a job with the Corps of Engineers. I don't need to look for a job now. I got one. Mm-hmm. And everybody got upset with me. My wife kind of got on the side of my family, so now she upset with me. And so I said, okay. I said, since y'all think it's so much better, I'm going to prove it to you that it's not any better. So I went down to TVA and applied for a job. They hired me on the spot. They didn't give me no, just like they did in the military, they didn't give me no test, no nothing. Yeah. They said, since you was in the military and you was over the drafting section,
you got it.
And you don't have to take no test, you have to do nothing, we hire you on the spot.
How did you feel?
I felt bad.
Why?
Because I wanted to leave Chattanooga. I'm tired of Chattanooga.
I feel bad.
So I said, I said, okay, I know what I'll do. Mm-hmm. Since they hired me, I won't tell anybody I'm hired. I just go see how to watch it.
They found out.
My mother got the phone call from the personnel man from TVA and told her that I had a job.
You have to go to work.
That's right.
Okay.
And I came home one day and everybody just smiling and just as happy as a lark. I said, what's going on? And my mother looked at me and just started smiling and said, you got a job. I said, where? She said, TV. I said, no. She said, yes. The personnel manager told me to tell you to come in tomorrow.
No. So you're working at TVA. You didn't get to leave. You're still in Chattanooga.
Right.
And, you know, you're living life. So when did the activist part start?
Well, besides what started in the military?
Yes.
It continued. It continued in TVA.
Yes. So it's kind of like a subtle, not violence, not forceful, not out in the open, but it's subtle. Cause you had a role to play in a lot of things, but your name just wasn't on it.
No, I don't mind who gets credit. I never have mind who got credit. All I want to do is work on the team.
Yeah. But you did a lot of good stuff.
I always do a lot of good stuff, but I don't mind getting credit for it.
Looking back, what would you say is the most significant, or which one of those moments stood out to you more, or that you are proud of? And you could only pick one.
I picked one. When I came back from the military, I told my wife I was through with church. I'd given up on church.
Mm-hmm.
Because I saw so much coming from Vietnam and all that stuff. And I said, the church ain't doing it. I won't say what I said.
Mm-hmm,
but church not doing anything. And Martin Luther King had trouble with the black church too. So yeah. I'm watching him and all this stuff. So I'm through with the church. Now my wife is highly religious. She was in church every time the church door opened. She was the secretary of the church. And so We even married my wife. I told her I was through with church. So we having this debate. We didn't argue about it too much. We talked things out.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, she said, well, what you gonna do with the children? Well, we didn't have any children at the time. I said, well, when we have some, they'll be able to go to church.
Okay.
I said, I don't mind them going to church. I'll take them to church, but I'm coming back home watching football. And so we had this debate for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ralph McDaniel came to Second Baptist Church. And my wife knew of somebody's resume. And Ralph McDaniel had been to Selma with Dr. King.
Okay.
And so she said to me, said, you need to go talk to the new preacher we got in church. She might want to do something. He might want to do something. She's talking about Ralph. See, they almost put me out of church when I was a little boy. Because that's one thing I want to do in church. See, mm-hmm. I want to have a ping pong table. I want a pool table in church.
You're trying to have fun.
Yeah, I thought anything you could do that's wholesome and good could be done in church. I thought that. But I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to carry it out while I was a little boy, and they almost put me out of church. And so I had some bad experience in church. But I had some good experience too. But anyway, she kept up with me to see Ralph McDaniel. So I said, okay, I'll go up there and talk to this preacher. But he's just like all the rest of the preachers. He ain't going to do nothing mm-hmm. that I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to see Ralph McDaniel. And I told him all the things I want to do. I said, I think we ought to get an industrial membership to the Y where we teach people swimming. We can have volleyball and basketball. And we have a mixed boys and girls. You couldn't have a volleyball team without at least two girls.
Okay.
So you have to get the boys to come to play. So I knew how to deal with teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sitting here telling Ralph McDaniel, he was a great listener. So he just sitting there listening to me. And when I got through, he said, you don't expect me to do all this, do you? He said, I'm a pastor. I have babies to seniors to take care of. I have to minister to a church. I can't be doing all this stuff. And when he was going on like that, I done turned him off.
Okay.
I'm ready to go out the door. But when he got to the good part, I didn't hear. Because he said, if you want to do it, I'll make the resources of church available to you. I didn't hear that part. I'm walking out the door. And I said, what did you say? And he repeated. I went back and sat down. And that's how I got involved with young people. That's how I got involved with politics. That's how I became a civil rights fighter.
Okay. Now from there, is that when you got involved with PUSH?
That was part of PUSH.
Okay.
The first one we got involved was the Unity Group.
Okay.
The first people I got involved was Reverend Wright with the Action Coordinating Council, affiliate of the CLC, Dr. King's organization.
Okay.
We was called the Instant Pickets.
Talk about your time there and what you guys all did.
Well, that's when I came back from the military. The only person I thought was doing anything was Reverend Wright because he was picketing everybody. I thought Reverend Wright was my kind of preacher.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I hooked up with him and we were picketing. We had pickets in our, we had picket signs in our trunk. We just, if you tell us you got a problem, we go picket it.
Okay.
We don't worry about the solution, we just picket it.
Okay.
That's a solution to every problem.
Okay.
We thought we'd right and everybody else wrong. That's where we felt at the time. And we were just about right. And so I got hooked up with our right and we started picketing. And we was doing a little there, doing the same thing. And so one day at what we call that place, it was a fast food place downtown. McDonald's.
Okay.
Black manager opened. I didn't know the black manager left. She knew me. She was a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Open. And some people and some of the workers came to the Action Coordinating Council talking about how they treat them. So we just started picking them. I didn't go talk to them, I just started picking them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sent a message. I said, tell Jenny to come here and talk to me. I said, I don't need to go in there and talk to her. She just needs to straighten this mess out and be through with it, and we'll go home. Well, she came out there and got me. And said, Jenny, what's the problem? I said, who are you? She said, I'm the manager. I said, sure, man. I didn't know we had no black managers. That's when I had to change my way of thinking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I went in and talked to her a little while, and we solved the problem.
Okay, good.
And that's when I began. I had to rethink the way I looked at things.
Okay, because it's not always
sometimes what you think it is or how it seems.
Well, that's because things were changing, but it was the way I used to think it was. And I thought it was still that way. I had to change my thinking.
To match the times. Okay. So from there, Push. Talk about Push and that initiative, how it came about.
Okay, now that's a real crazy one. You already got the unity group.
Yes.
And so a guy, Reverend Richards was dealing with Erlanger.
Okay.
And he was trying to unionize the workers at Erlanger, Reverend Richards Walker. Mm-hmm. And it got too big for him. So he come to the Action Coordinating Council and asked us to help him. I said, yeah. So we started dealing with Erlanger, and somehow a guy named Eddie Bibbins. And he was a guy that hung around civil rights leaders, but he was a con man. Mm-hmm. That's what he was. So he was always before the media. He was a good media person. So he got before the media and said one day, sir, if y'all don't sell this situation at Erlanger one day, I'm going to bring Jesse Jackson to town. And we wasn't thinking about nothing like that.
Yeah.
But he said it. And it went like wildfire all over the community. And the first thing I went to Reverend Wright, and Reverend McDaniel said, I don't know what's happening, but we got to make Jesse Jackson come down. And so the preachers got together and called Jesse Jackson.
They came down.
Well, he didn't just come here. He said he would come here if we started a Push chapter. And before he came, he sent his lieutenancy in to evaluate the city of Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Jesse Jackson, when he came here, knew as much about the city of Chattanooga as I did.
Yeah. Oh, he was not playing.
No, he wasn't playing. And so after he got through doing his thing about Erlanger and everything else we had, he said, well, who's going to be the organizer for the Push chapter? All the ministers pointed directly to me and said, General Hall, now this is 12
o'clock. You didn't want that?
No. So, because I have written a position paper saying the problem with Chattanooga is we got too many organizations.
You're about to have one more.
And I'm about to have one more. That goes against everything I'm for.
Yeah.
So I'm against Push coming to town. So Jesse Jackson is making a tour of the state of Tennessee. So he tells me that I got to go on tour with him till we sell this argument. I said, what do you mean I got to go on tour with you? I said, I got a job.
No, you don't.
Jesse Jackson said, well, who are your preacher? I told him, Reverend McDaniel. He told Reverend McDaniel, put him on leave from his job. Don't you know who the Reverend McDaniel said? Yeah, I can get him on leave. Now, it's at 12 o'clock at night. I'm saying that I got a wife. I got to go and report my wife. We don't have time for that. Reverend McDaniel going to tell your wife where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at this. I said, this man is stone crazy. But Reverend McDaniel said, I can do that.
So he was gone.
So I left. No clothes, no nothing. With clothes on my back. I went across state Tennessee, arguing with Jesse Jackson about it. And I'm going to tell you, he won the argument. You can tell that.
But it was fun. It was for a great purpose.
But he won the argument because he said, Holloway, we believe the same thing. He said, I know you got too many organizations in Chattanooga. He said, what you need is an organization. See, he said, think about them like a patch quilt. All these organizations is a patch that can be made into a quilt.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Operation Push is going to be the thread that put all of them together, and we're going to protect the black community with this quilt. Mm-hmm. And what Jesse Jackson told me. And I looked at him and said, now that's what I have just wrote about. And I'm still kind of skeptical. So we got to Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
52,000 people in the stadium to hear Jesse Jackson. I had never seen nothing like that before. And we took up some money. And this is the God's truth. And Jesse Jackson gave me about $50,000. I said, hold it. Put it in a paper bag. Because we didn't have no bank open at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting up here scared. Don't know what I'm going to do with this money. So I'm got my back to the wall so can't nobody get behind me. And I'm kind of, what this man giving me all this money for? And so he tells me sometime later that we have evaluated all of the people in Chattanooga. He said, although you're not a leader, he said, but you got more credibility than anybody else in Chattanooga. He said, you're the only man that don't have a business. You're not a preacher. You don't have any money, but you got good credibility with children, and grassroots people. That's what they found out when they took evaluation and when he sent it. And he said, my name kind of out on top. That's what he, so when they said for you to be the organizer of Operation Push, I immediately jumped on it and I wasn't gonna turn it loose till I got you.
So PUSH, standing for People United to Save Humanity.
And sometimes to save humanity. We use it.
Okay. And the program promoted education, and it taught youth the importance of using their talents and skills to help their community. How long was PUSH active?
PUSH was active since 1976. PUSH. Mm-hmm. PUSH XL was in, came back about four or five years late.
Okay. And I know that you've been trying to revive that.
Yes, that's what this is right here.
Okay. We've been trying to revive this. Yes, I read this here.
Yes. And that's the package I'm passing out. See, the only thing I can do now is pass the information out to people who are around children. And that means parents. If you got some teenage children and you want, now that's what you do. You need this package. Because I carried this package out with my children. I tried Operation PUSH and PUSH XL with my children before I adopted it for the city. It works. I know it works because it worked for my children.
Now tell me, describe some of the initiatives, the things that you use in PUSH that worked with your children.
You don't PUSH XL, difference between PUSH and PUSH XL.
PUSH XL.
The basic principles of PUSH start with five basic principles. The first one is, you got to get the kids' attention. Then you get the attendance. Then you get the attitude. Then you can change the aptitude. And if you can do those four things, you're gonna have achievement. That's, and I don't care how you look at all this material I got, that's the principles you're gonna deal with. All this material.
And this is just supporting.
Yeah, those are, and you have parent pledges, you have student pledges, and a student pledge simply says, I will cut my TV, television, and my cell phone off 2 to 3 hours a night for the study period.
Yes.
That's the basic principle. The parents' pledge is that I will pick up my report card every 9 months from my school. My kid won't bring it home to me, I'll go get it. And then I will change telephone numbers with my teachers and principals. Those are basic principles of parents' pledges.
So kind of a way to kind of keep parents accountable for their kids and their upbringing and their learning and their education, as well as setting kids straight.
Yeah, and then the parents supposed to pick up the report card and sign it. And you can also have your preacher to sign the report card. I think that should be a standard in school.
Yes, because they be hiding. I used to hide my grades when they was bad. Yes.
And then at the beginning of every school year, the principal should have a state of the school address. Whereas, all the whereas. You'll see them in the first part here, the whereas. See that? State of school address. You should deal with that. Principals and the teachers and everybody should deal with that. It's all right now. You don't have to think of nothing. You don't have to. All you got to do is follow it.
No, this is good. This is.
And then the next one is what PUSH Battlecry. No, that's the PUSH XL program itself. That's explaining the whole program. That's the booklet that you have for PUSH XL. That's the booklet. And then after that is the PUSH Battlecry. I think it's called that PUSH Battlecry now somewhere.
It's
a yellow.
Is it this?
No, that's not it. I don't know what that is. I think it's too far. Let's see. Let's back up a little bit.
Oh, I think it's this page.
Yeah, that's it right there. This is it right here. The PUSH Battlecry. I am somebody. I know that by heart. And then we can revise it depending on the group we're talking to. I can say that by heart.
It's like an affirmation.
That's affirmation. I am somebody. It's a wonderful thing. for children to believe that, say that to themselves.
Yes.
Nobody has to reaffirm that you are great, that your hair might be different, but I am
Your
skin might be different, but I am. Red, yellow, black, or white, we all perfect in God's eyes. If my mind is pure, I can learn anything in the world. If my mind can believe it in my heart, if my mind can teach it, if my mind can believe it in my heart, achieve it.
Yes, what I'm saying. Yes, I've heard that.
All that's good. And then I must be respected, never neglected, but always protected.
Because
I'm God's child.
Yes.
We can do that any kind of way. And if you got dealing with nothing but women, I might be a female, but I am somebody. Dealing with mixed group, you mix them together. You can do almost anything.
So in the process of trying to revive the Push Excel, I read in the chat news article that you said wanting to revive the program, stating that it can promote education and instill in youth to consider working for the good for their community. Do you still feel like with our youth today?
Let me tell you, last January, I went to a youth conference.
Yes.
And we had about 60 students from university. All they talked about was their major, what they were doing in school,
mm-hmm.
what they're going to do when they graduate, mm-hmm. how much money they want to make.
Mm-hmm.
And they said nothing about advancing the black community. Let me tell you something else happened at that meeting. In Nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know who she is, but she used to be the principal of Howard, and ain't about that now.
Okay.
She's also now working for the foundation. Her job is to try to get black kids to major in education.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
See, we got a misconception of education. See, we think education is just teaching. There's a lot of aspects to education. It got some good salaries in it too.
Yes.
See, that's the misconception people have. I don't want to be no teacher because I don't pay nothing. But a lot of things in education, you get paid some money.
That's true.
And so we need education. We need black teachers like we need air and water. And especially black male teachers. Very important that the male be present
mm-hmm.
in children's life. And so these kids that were there at that workshop just talked about that, and that was nothing about the community. Now, I'm a village kid.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised by a village in the projects. So I was different by a lot of people. And if I didn't say, hello, how you doing when I'm coming home, folks, I knew it. My parents knew it before they got home. And I got a whooping about
that. Yes, the respect.
That's right. You're supposed to speak to these people. Especially sitting on the porch and waving at you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I'm a village kid, no question about that. My mother and father worked, but the lady next door took care of us when we came home. We had to go through her house before we went next door to our own house, so she could see whether we were all together or not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's a fact of life. That's just a fact of life. That's the way life walks. And so it disturbed me that these kids, then I asked the question at the end of the program, I asked the question, how many of you students have heard of Push XL? Not one of them raised their hand. Then I asked the question to the audience, how many of you in the audience had raised it? Now, these are parents now, and
okay.
they were in school doing Excel. And just about everybody that raised their hand. And I said, that tells me something. There's a gap between those students
and that
audience. And I said, maybe I need to revise Excel. Now, we don't have Jesse Jackson anymore to give them the rah-rah mm-hmm, speeches, mm-hmm. and we don't have the budget of $3,000 a year plus what we could raise. A staff of 12 people to have all that.
Yes.
But what can I do? Just Johnny Holloway himself. What can you do? And I said, I got all the stuff at home. How come I don't make a package and just give it out?
Yes.
And let me tell you what I did Saturday. I wasn't feeling too good, so I didn't go to the Martin Luther King prayer breakfast. I called a friend of mine, Irvin Overton, and said, Irvin, I'm going to send you 20 of these packages. And I want you to pass them out at the Martin Luther King breakfast. I have passed out almost 150 of these packages. And let me tell you, I'm stealing a little feedback now.
Yes.
I was at Erlango yesterday for a doctor's appointment. Jay was with me. And the guy looked at me and said, you that guy was at the Piney Woods that day, and you told us about Push XL. I said, that's right. I said, I'm that guy. And I'm telling you, he was working class person, and that's the people I like the most, people who work class. I love the working class. I like to see them working and lift themselves up. I love it. And so we got and we just talked a little bit, and I told him, Jason, now that's the affirmation of what I'm doing. To him, that's all I'm interested in. I don't want to know what the people up here think about me. No, I just want to know the people I'm communicating with, what they say.
Yes.
And another guy looked at me one day and said, oh, you that push man.
Yes.
That's the affirmation.
So they already identify you with it.
Yes.
So it's definitely coming back.
I'm trying to make it come back. And then my church, Second Baptist Church, said they would print as many of these as I want. And they have almost printed 200 of these for me already.
No, that's good. So the more you get these out, the more that people can reach out, and then you get the word
now,
out.
It's just a matter of they're doing it for themselves.
That's true.
The only way nobody will save us from us but us.
That's true. That's true.
That's the philosophy behind the whole idea. We don't have any great voice coming out trying to tell us what to do now. It's all about what you want to do for yourself. You take a page like this and carry it out. That's all you have to do.
But the more that you know about the program, is it still on? Yeah. The more that, did it fall?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, was it bad?
Mm-mm. Just like it.
Wait, no.
For both of us?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh.
See if I can find it. This says it all. It says the more you read, the more you know, the more you know, the more you grow, the more you grow, the better you'll be. Something like that.
Because you were talking about when you did go to that event, and there you noticed that gap between the parents and the children. So it's just about them knowing, because this is a good program. Of course, it's an excellent program. It's just about this generation now knowing to where they're able to apply.
Yes.
All that's in here. So I believe it definitely serves some value.
The more you read, the more you know. The more you know, the smarter you grow. The smarter you grow, the stronger your voice. When you speak, your mind will make your choice. It's simple philosophy. And then at the very end, see, and also we got something for churches. It's a program for churches. And then at the end of this whole thing, I don't know whether I got one here or not. I know you got one in this one. Coming after that. We got something like Excel Thought for the Week. In here you got all these sayings that you can just print out for your child to read. And it just says little things like that. So it's all that for you. You don't have to do nothing but carry it out. You don't have to think of nothing. You don't have to come up with no ideas. Just carry it out. It's simple.
It's like a rubric to life.
It's simple, just carry it out.
I like that. So when you think about, you've done a lot. You've been through a lot. When you think about all that you've been through and all that you've done, is this the, and then you also look at the community today. Is this the vision that you imagined for us? Is it matching what you were fighting for?
Not quite. It's a journey, and we're still on it. And that part of the moth up there, what I told you about all those sayings that it started out with, that we were slaves, and then we was colored, and then we was Negroes, and James Brown came along and said, I'm black and I'm proud. And then we was Afro-American, and then Jesse Jackson came along and said, I am somebody. That's the journey we gone through.
Yeah.
Now that's where we are now. Where do we go from there is the journey. And I am saying that where I think we go is the dual citizenship, both for Africa and America.
All countries in Africa?
I'm saying Africa becomes a United States of Africa. I'm saying that's what has to happen. And we become citizens. We can pick the country we want to be a citizen in right now, if we want to.
Yes.
And you have dual citizenship, both of Africa and America.
Yes.
That's I think that's the next step we go through.
Okay.
Well, I see a lot of people, I don't know if you've been seeing, but a lot of people, especially celebs, are going over there and they're doing some of that.
Let me tell you about Operation Push.
Okay.
Before Jesse Jackson started running for president, we was participating in the African-American Summit Conference. We sent two people from Chattanooga to Africa. And there's a book up there full of it. And so we was on that line, and I was thinking about doing a citizenship then. But then Jesse went and run for president, so we scrapped all that.
Yeah. I thank you so much, Mr. Holloway, for letting me, taking me along your journey, learning about you, learning about all the wonderful stuff you've done. I definitely love this vision for how we move forward, and I pray that we definitely get to see this.
Well, all we have to do is watch the Kwanzaa principles and deal with them.
And we will, and I'm definitely looking forward to getting to seeing Push XL back in this community. And in our future.
We'll see. I don't know what's going to happen.
It's going to happen. We're going to speak it into existence. It is going to happen in the name of Jesus. But thank you so much for sitting with us. We could go all day. I could sit here and listen to you all day.
You before I get through all of that crap, but I didn't have time. So you must be a good interviewer.
That's good. So I thank you so much. And
you can't have that. That's my master. You can have this one if you like.
Okay. And thank you so much, and we will definitely have all this information for you guys, Chattanooga, to view and get along with this movement of Push, Excel, and Reviving It right here in our community. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Mr. Holloway. Chattanooga, I'll get up with you later. It's your girl, Zion MK, here with Brewer Media Group. Woo!
Thank you.